Welcome back, everyone, to On the Draw. This is episode 2. I'm alongside Mythic Fish Mom, as always. How are you doing, Myth?
I'm good. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. You brought back Endormir with you tonight. He expressed interest to be on the show again, so we thought, bring him back. Everybody loves Endormir. How are you doing, Endormir?
I'm doing fine.
All right. First off, I would like to thank everyone who tuned in last week. We had quite a bit of success. We had 150 or so plays on different formats that we posted this on. So thank you guys for tuning in. But we've got some stuff to go over this week. We are going to talk about some deck lists and things to watch out for in the tournament that's coming up this weekend, the Hextech Open. That's going to be a little bit later on. We're also going to be talking about some rare cards that just haven't found a home in the current metagame right now. And we're hoping that they'll get a boost in set 2 and later sets. That'll be later on in the show as well, but we're going to start it off with talking about the conventions that are going on this coming weekend. We've got a couple. There's Gen Con here in the United States, and then there's Gamescom, which is overseas, and we're expecting to see some kind of new information about Hex come out. Corey is going to be attending Gamescom in Europe, and I'm sure there's going to be, you know, CZ support at Gen Con as well, and we're hoping, you know, we're going to see some things. So, Mythic, what do you think we're going to find out? What kind of new info do you think is going to be shed over there at the conventions this weekend?
Well, I would expect to see some amount of set 2 spoilers, considering people are going to be playing with the cards. I'm sure there's going to be some screenshots or what have you of the cards. I don't expect the full set to be in, because I doubt they coded it this fast, or that's entirely coded and ready to go for Gen Con and Gamescom. But I do expect to see some more spoilers come out. Also, I'd like to see maybe a set date on when set 2 will be coming out, as well as potentially open beta, like when we can see that coming into here. So those are like the things I expect to see. It'd be nice to hear, you know, how far along they are in PvE and all that kind of stuff too, but I don't expect to hear that yet.
All right, and how about you, Endormir?
Yeah, I agree there that having them shipped, well, not shipped, flight Corey to Germany means that they probably have some kind of big announcement to say. I know they really dislike giving us dates and time frames, so maybe that's not it, but as Mythic said, we should probably see a lot of set 2, maybe even like 60-70% even spoiled, as they're going to be drops with set 2 and probably pre-cons in there. So I expect that even if they are not official spoilers, the community will post their findings on Twitter or the local forums, one of the local forums, the official forums and stuff. But yeah, I think there's going to be a big announcement. It could be open beta, it could be set 2. There's a couple of options. The thing is that if we go for the E3 announcement that they said, it said that they wanted to release set 2 by the end of August. So that should be, that will mean like next week or the week after that, which I don't think is realistic right now. But we never know, maybe they already have it'll prepare then are ready to go.
Yeah, and I tend to agree as well. You know, if they're going to put Corey on a plane and fly him across the ocean to go talk at Gamescom, I'm assuming that there's going to be some decent information coming out of that. You know, I would like to find out more information about the new keyword tunneling. We know that that's the new keyword. We don't know specifics of it, but I'm interested to find out what that is. We're hopefully going to get an open beta date. You know, we've got open beta dates. We've got trading dates. We've got PvE dates. Like, I know that they really don't like talking about dates because it's very hard for them to stick to what they say just because of all the variables that come with coding a game and, you know, introducing new cards, and they screw up everything else that's going on in the game. So that's a little tricky to do. One thing I'd like to add is if they do give an open beta date or a PvE date or anything like that, set 2 date, I don't want them to rush it. Like, granted, Hex is a little stale right now. Like, there's not many people in the Proving Grounds. I know tournament, yeah, I mean, it's a little stale, but tournaments are firing off at a, you know, a decent rate. It's better than back before, like, you know, we had that serious doldrum where there was literally no one in the Proving Grounds. You know, there's a couple people in there, and tournaments do fire off every now and again, but I don't want them to rush anything. I don't want it to be a bad transition into open beta. I don't want it to be a bad transition into set 2. That just causes a lot of problems, and it's going to shy new people away from the game. What do you think about that, Myth?
Yeah, I mean, if they go into open beta and the game's just a buggy mess, it's going to hurt them a lot. So I would hope that they would be willing to hold things off and just get things in there correctly, as opposed to just pushing it out there, getting whatever they can out as fast as possible, and potentially hurting the growth of the game overall. With the set, with the discovering what tunneling is, they said they're gonna be doing, having Ben Stoll, I believe it is, do a article on tunneling. So maybe we'll see that either like in the Friday update or sometime soonish. We'll also see what the cards do, obviously, if they have any tunneling cards at Gen Con, which they may or may not have, because again, those could be not programmed in yet or whatnot. But yeah, we should be seeing what that does soon enough.
Okay. All right. And Dormy, what do you think about the whole release date process? Do you think they need to push it out to get more people into the game, to get it more, a little more active, or do you think they should just hold off, make sure everything's perfect before they get back into it?
I definitely think they don't want to rush it. I wouldn't say that the transition to open beta was super bad, but not being able to play tournaments in like, what it was, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I don't know, it felt like months, just because there was really not much to do, as people didn't want to open their packs because they were saving them for draft. So there, and because there were no drafts far enough, people in the Proving Grounds were playing with the starter decks. So it was a really, really dull period. I don't want a repeat of that. So I'd rather wait more for a more solid build. But I don't know. I mean, there's things that they can test, and there's going to be unexpected bugs and so on. So it's not as they can predict everything perfectly. Also, I was just going to say that on the tunneling keyword, we're probably going to see it on Gen Con, unless it's a super complicated, well, not super complicated, but hard to core mechanic and not as streamlined or, yeah, not a simple mechanic that has some kind of coding issues or stuff like that, which may make them not to include the tunneling cards. But as it being one of the core mechanics on set 2, I think they want to spoil it on Gen Con, especially if they wanted to release set 2 later this month.
One thing I like to add about the whole Gen Con and people drafting with set 2 and everything is it allows people to get ready for when set 2 does drop. You kind of have an idea of what the stronger archetypes are in draft, what to look for, what to pass, all that kind of thing. Because, they're, like you said, you know, Hex might not officially spoil X number of cards or whatever, but the community, people that go to Gen Con and have the experience to play with these cards firsthand, I'm sure that there will be forum posts and, you know, people talking over Skype, and the word gets out. I mean, it's just word of mouth is crazy when it comes to video games, and, you know, everybody's excited, so that information does need to get out there in one way or another. So I'm thinking that, you know, this weekend there's going to be quite a few things that are going to at least get me hopeful for what's going to happen in the near future with Hex. And now, going into other things, we have the Hextex Open starting this weekend. I think we have around 50 to 60 people signed up right now. I'm not exactly sure. I don't have it open in front of me. But
I think it's 54 last I checked.
Which is a decent number. You know, it's something on a weekend where there's other things going on, so we weren't expecting a vast number of people coming in. But we are going to be doing a pre-tournament show on Thursday to go over just the rules again so everybody knows what's going on, and we're going to be talking about bannings and all that kind of stuff. And Mythic's going to be hosting that on our official stream. How's that going to go, Myth?
Well, it's probably going to be me, maybe one of you two, or somebody else coming on with me, so I don't have to be so boring. But I'll basically just be saying what cards are banned, which are at the current moment would be Relentless Corruption. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that it may get patched or something that fixes it in between now and Thursday when it would be doing the stream. But that's not super likely, but we'll wait it out and see if they go for it. But yeah, so it'll be just me talking about that, probably go over the rules a little bit more. And yeah, nothing too dramatic, probably won't be a very long stream, just, again, letting everyone know what's going on, how it's going to work out, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we discussed it, and we think that's the best way to actually go about getting the information of the community is announcing on the podcast that we're going to be doing a pre-show where everybody can tune in that's going to be in the tournament and find out these are the rules once more, exactly set in stone, face to face. You know what's going to happen. We don't want anybody mistakenly getting dropped from the tournament because they didn't submit a deck list or anything like that. So it's just to keep everything fresh in people's minds. And to do it face-to-face, I think, is the best way to do it.
Real fast, though. Also, to be honest, I know I don't read most rules and regulations, so I'm sure other people haven't as well. So maybe the first time some people who have signed up for the tournament are also knowing the rules. So while we are basically reading off what we're already written about, not everyone will know the rules that have signed up for it already. So yeah, always good to cover it verbally as opposed to just, you know, having a written article about it.
Exactly. All right. And yeah, so everybody that still wants to sign up, they're still open. You need to go on to Challenge and look up Hextex TV. You'll find the tournament there. Sign up. It's going to be a good time. We're going to have live coverage on our official Twitch stream at twitch.tv/HextexTV. It's going to be a good time. I'll be there. I won't be playing in it, unfortunately. None of the Hextex will, but I will be there probably chat moderating or being used as a judge if people have questions about deck lists or anything like that. And I'm sure a lot of the other Hextex will be there as well. So it's going to be a good time. We're excited about it. We're excited to see what kind of decks, you know, fringe decks people decide to brew up to surprise people on the fly and everything like that. So it's going to be a good time. Check it out, guys. And with that out of the way, we're going to talk about some of the decks that you need to keep your eye on for this tournament. These are some of the decks that we think are going to be stronger and are going to place better results than just some random stuff that people throw together. You know, obviously sideboarding being in this tournament, it's going to change things up a little bit. You can't just throw together a 60-card Gore Feast deck and expect to slam everybody because they will have answers for you. They will be prepared for that deck. So we just want to touch on what we think is going to be strong and what we think sideboarding is going to bring to the table to either benefit or make these decks worse than you originally thought. And we're going to toss it over to Endormi to start this off. What deck are we going to talk about first, Endormi?
So I think that one of the most popular decks, due to its availability on the monetary side and its power, is Gore Storm or Gore Feast variants. So we are probably going to see a fair amount of Gore Feast decks. And the addition of sideboards makes them able to change their plans a little bit on gaming 2 and 3. If they are facing a mirror match, they can sideboard some cards against it to be better suited instead of having to have one or two of them in the main deck for that, which are usually pretty bad against control. On the same vibe, if they are playing against control, they can sideboard some of the slower cards and put some better control matchups, like if you are playing Sapphire, it can be counter Mike. Not all of them play on the main deck. So having the diverse threats will pump a little bit the power of the deck, but I don't think that Reserve is going to impact too much the power of Gore Storm or Gore Feast variants in general. So I think it's going to keep a similar power level as we saw on other tournaments.
Well, for sure, Gore Feast in general is just like the aggro card. For the fact that you could just slam it and win at almost any point in the game, there's very few turns where you top deck a Gore Feast and you go, oh man, I would have rather have top decked, you know, anything else on my deck. So Gore Storm is definitely the aggro deck. That's the only real aggro deck we have on our list here, and that's because it's really the only aggro deck that's viable in the format currently, at least in my opinion. With the ability to tempo everybody out with your Buccaneers and your Time Ripples and in your reserves, you have the counter magics and the Groks and such, and then just slamming down a Gore Feast and, you know, stealing wins out of nowhere. Like Norman was saying, the reserves shouldn't matter too much. They just don't really add a whole lot because, again, the power of the deck is in its tempo and the Gore Feast itself, which is in the main deck. But having the ability to counter extinctions and, you know, things that mess up your plan of killing your opponent is always nice to have in there.
Yeah, and I tend to agree, and I want to preface this segment, right, or this deck that we're talking about right now, is not just Gore Storm. I think it's just the Gore Feast archetype in general. I've been on Hex recently, and I started trying to test a mono-red Gore Feast deck. It's obviously not as resilient as the Sapphire Ruby variant, but it is really fast, and it's pretty consistent. You know, you try and curve out, you try and go one drop, two drop, or one drop, one drop, one drop, into three, and then drop your Gore Feast, and unless they have a way to interact, it's pretty potent. And I know Mythic has been tooling around with a Blood Ruby Gore Feast kind of deck, and that can be sweet too, because that not only can put the games away fast, but it also has resilience due to life gain that you get off of the Gore Feast, you know, with Corrupt Harvesters or Vampire Kings. So there's a lot of different ways that you can build this. I personally, not last tournament, but the tournament before, played a version of the deck that was Diamond Ruby that was called Pet Shop, and it was all about using the high-value troops that you drop out and, like, shell safe sure shot where you drop out him and he gets a pet, and therefore you're getting pretty much double your money when you end up actually casting Gore Feast. It didn't work out wonders. I placed like 32nd or 26th to 32nd, somewhere in that range, so it wasn't bad. But there's a lot of different ways you can build this deck, and with that there's a lot of different ways you can sideboard, you know. And I think that's the power of that kind of card, is you can throw it into so many different builds, and with those so many different builds you have so many different options in your sideboard that, you know, like, you're expecting control to be a really, really difficult matchup, and you're expecting to see a lot of people playing that. So you might want to play a couple of Chaos Keys in the sideboard or random things like that. So I think it's a very resilient archetype, and I think it's going to be sticking around for quite some time, especially after we get new cards in set two. So it's definitely a deck to watch for. And if you're playing in the tournament, you want to have some kind of way to plan to beat this deck, because it's going to be there. And the next deck that we're going into is, oh god, let's slow roll everyone. Let's play some Blood Diamond. And Dormy, what do you think about Blood Diamond?
I think it's a pretty strong deck, and it's going to see some play for sure. But it's probably what most people consider one of the best decks, if not the best deck on set one. So I will put a couple of people on that for sure. The addition of sideboards to this deck helped it a lot, improving the Gorfist matchup, for example, by quite a bit, as they can sideboard in Blinding Lights to deal with that. So it's I think the sideboard it's going to help them a lot. Say they also can sideboard a specific cards, for example, Pact of Pain is really, really good in the control matchups, but it's really, really poor on the aggro matchups, and being able to swap those cards around, and it helps them a lot.
Yeah, and also, like, this deck, similar to Gorefeast, you have the ability to kind of steal games with, like, a free turn two angel. Will just end a lot of games really quickly, as well as Soul Marble by itself ends games very easily. Especially if you're playing Dimmid, which most of the Blood Diamond decks do play. I do see some Zarud still running around, but Dimmid's usually the correct champion for this deck. And just gaining 6 life off of a 6-6 spell shield against aggro matchups can be really devastating. Or, like, if you have an early angel, gaining 4 life early in the game, as well as having a nice blocker back, again, can be really devastating. One thing I've seen a lot of decks starting to run with this deck, with Blood Diamond, has been Drew, because Drew plus Soul Marble plus Dimmid, as we saw in the Sapphire Diamond deck that Indormi was tooling around with a little earlier on, can be really powerful as well. So with Drew in the deck, it speeds up the deck a little bit post reserves, which could be helpful in the, you know, mono blood matchups or anything that kind of can't deal with anything that doesn't play Repel mostly or Nature Rains. So I do think the Blood Diamond deck, rather, gets much better with the availability of reserves, with adding more Pact of Pains, like Indormi was saying, as well as adding Druze and stuff like that, Sorrows potentially even as well. So, deck that was already really powerful and the bane of a lot of people's existence in set one, gonna get a little bit of a boost from the reserves, I think.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it's one of those decks that's solid with a main 60-card deck, and then it just tends to get so much better post-board. You know, like, turn 2 Soul Marble is threat enough, and turn 4 Extinction is threat enough to just completely throw you off your game plan, that, you know, they can do a lot of things post-board. Like you said, Sorrow or Blinding Light against Gorfy's decks. There's a lot of resilience to get you back on your game plan and put the other person off of their game plan. It kind of one card can completely shift the course of the game. And I think that one of the key things about playing against Blood Diamond is knowing what your opponent is capable of doing and when. You know, like, if I'm playing a Gorfy's deck and I'm playing against Blood Diamond, I'm not necessarily just going to flood the board with my troops. That's not generally going to be the best way to try and beat them. Or, I mean, if you think, it might be. You know, you might try and, if you have the curve, if you have 1-drop, 2-drop, 3-drop, or Gorefeast, you might want to just go for it. But if they break up that combo, combo in quotations kind of a thing, if they break that up, you're kind of out of gas. And you're kind of digging yourself out of a hole trying to get back into the game. So, you know, I think that Blood Diamond control's going to be around. After the last tournament, the last challenge series, there was kind of a drop-off. I know I personally, in 3 rounds, I played 2 people that were playing Blood Diamond control, but from talking to people on Skype, I don't think it was as as predominant than it was in previous tournaments. I think people were trying different things. People were trying to hedge against it. And I think Gorfy's trying to get under that deck is probably one of the best ways to do it. You know, there's other decks, obviously, that can try and battle it in the long game. And we'll get to some of those a little bit later. But Blood Diamond is definitely a threat, and it's definitely something you need to look out for. So prepare for that. And with that, we're going to go on to another new deck. It's a relatively new deck that had a little bit of success in the last Challenge Series. What deck is that, Mythic?
Well, it's Infinite Fog. It's made by Zubrin and I believe his team of Russians with Meet the Future and a bunch of other guys. Well, I don't necessarily know. I know Zubrin and Meet the Future are definitely the ones working on it. What the deck does is play cards like Blinding Light, Immortality, Pact of Pain, a bunch of other like prevent damage effects. And with Immortality plus Pact of Pain, you can let yourself die casting Immortality and then just draw a bunch of cards. And every time you would go to zero, you then go back to 10. So it gives you basically five more cards off of your Pact of Pain, essentially. So it has really, really powerful synergies with those two cards, especially. And then you can win off Relentless Corruption, which they'll probably be playing Chronic Madness, which is what they did for the last tournament, because Relentless Corruption has been in that one as well. But the ability to just draw all of your deck off of preventing all that damage and the Immortality plus Pact of Pain combo is really, really potent. The only downside they do have is the timer. The timer will defeat this deck more times than other decks will. That's what my experience was with it, at least. I just kept losing the time because it was just so slow and so grindy. It's fun. It's very fun to play if you're into those kind of decks, which I am, but time is of the essence.
Yeah, the one thing is that you have to, I think Zubrin explained it in Twitter, that you have to put some priorities, some automatic priorities, you have to make them automatic to pass, so you only interact in key phases, and that speed ups your clock quite a bit. But talking about Infinite Fog or Turbo Fog in the tournament, I think that it was a great metagame call for them, for a tournament without reserves, as you can surprise game one and you can just snowball that victory into game 2 and 3. But I do think that it gets quite worse after sideboard, especially against the Gorfy's decks. One of the strengths of Gorfy's was that it can potentially win anything. If he gets the good hand and the opponent stumbles a little bit, it wins. And an Infinite Fog really has a period where it's a little bit vulnerable, especially when they can only play one effect a turn and their Pact of Pain is not yet online. So a combination of pressure plus counter magic, that's usually what most Ghost Storm decks are going to pour against them, I think it's going to really hurt the deck. In addition, some also Ghost Storm variants play with Reginald, and Reginald goes through Immortality. It doesn't go through the Blinding Light, but it goes through Immortality in combat. And then when Reginald is on their decks, every activation of Pact of Pain, it's risky. And as the deck is by no means fast, I think the combination of Counter Mike and Reynald from the Gore Storm decks is going to make Infinite Fog not as a good choice as it was before.
I mean, with the Reginald idea, though, they do play repels and stuff, too, from their reserves. So, while Reginald can potentially just steal a game from them as well, because they have to they will draw a ton of cards, they do play a bunch of removal spells as well with the repels and murders and solitary exiles and such. So, while maybe that can be the case, I don't know that it's definitely a deterrent for not playing Infinite Fog if you're into those kind of decks.
I'm just saying that it's an additional stuff that is pretty annoying to deal with, especially on the early turns of the game. Because if you take it on turn 12, it's going to be hard to sneak it through. But on the early game, if you manage to sneak him through, it's going to be a pain for them. But as I said, I think the issue is the when they can only play one effect a turn or one card a turn, they can get potentially tempo out, and one counter magic effect can just end the game especially for the Ghost Storm variant. And against other controls decks, they can sideboard the cards that are not great against them and make the and just play against each other with the Pact of Pains, and if they have Exhalation cards like Runner's Corruption, go with that and try to even mill their opponents just with that.
Well, one thing that makes like this deck plus also the Blood Diamond deck, and sorry for if keep cutting you off, Phoenix, one thing that makes these kind of decks with the foggy effects is that they can go for the Blinding Light the turn that they're going to get Gore Feasted, and then the following turn go with an Extinction or a Sorrow or whatever they have suit the field after that, and they can kind of rebuild. The only problem then is also that they draw cards off of their Mirror Knights usually. So, but still, I feel like they're still solid against those decks, but they're not necessarily, you know, a shoo-in every time.
Yeah, go ahead, Phoenix.
Okay, I'll go with this one. I don't have much to say about the deck, but because I haven't seen it in action, I haven't played with it. But I would like to say that. I like the idea of the deck. It's something new. It's something fresh that's going on in the game, and that's always good for the community. I think that one of the weak points of this deck is against Mill. I wouldn't say that Mill's a tier one deck per se. Any variants of Mill is kind of on the fringe, 1.2, maybe tier two kind of a deck. But if you're expecting Turbo Fog and they're going to be drawing a bunch of cards and you're going to be milling a bunch of cards, that seems like a pretty good strategy to me. And then also the Reginald can be a good thing. If you can sneak it through, that's going to be the tricky part. If you can sneak Reginald through and get it into their deck, they're not going to be so apt to draw as many cards as they normally would. So it's two small things that could be used to hedge against this type of deck. And other than that, I mean, I like the idea of it. I like the idea of killing yourself and drawing a bunch of cards and then pump it back up to 10 life. That's just a cool effect. And I like to see people innovating and doing different things, especially when the metagame is where it's been for quite some time now. And for people to sit there and work together and design a new archetype is kind of cool, in my opinion. All right, and with that, we're going to go on to another deck that's had quite some success in recent tournaments. That is Mono Sapphire. I tried this deck, I guess it was at the end of Alpha. I was trying to do like a Mono Sapphire, really a tempo-y deck, and it just wasn't coming together. I wasn't getting the results that I wanted from it, so I'm assuming that my build wasn't correct, or maybe I just wasn't playing it right. I mean, that's always an option as well. But, Indormy, what do you think about Mono Sapphire?
Yeah, I also tried to make Mono Sapphire as best as possible, but the issue I had with Mono Sapphire is that its aggro decks are really, really hard to beat. So, I had high hopes for the deck I was running, but some just mono ruby, even mono ruby variants could be really, really, really bad, especially with one drops. Could be really, really bad because you don't start to interact them until turn two, turn three. You have the Buccaneers at the ripples, and they don't deal with the stuff. Same. So I think it the deck that won the last challenge series was Mono Sapphire and was main deck in Storm Cults for the Gore Feast and stuff like that. But I think it's. It's a deck that you really, for example, you're facing Gorfish, you really need the turn 5 Grog to buy you the necessary time. And if you don't get there, you can just get run over. And while I like the archetype, I do think it has a glaring weakness against aggro, and you depend of getting that Grog from turn 5.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It can card advantage out some control decks and, again, tempo out their Angels and their Vampire Kings and so on and so forth with their Buccaneers and Time Ripples and such. Same as Gore Feast in that vein, but they can go a little longer game. And with the Peak is just such a powerful card that just can't really be abused, per se, in other decks other than Mono Sapphire, because you get, obviously, deeper in your deck from playing just Sapphire. And, you know, with the Dreamers, and I'm not sure if they play Mentals. I haven't looked at the list in a little bit. But, like, just the amount of card draw you get and the card selection you get off of Peak can really help the deck be really, really powerful. And just ending the game with, like, Master Your Time with Garalks, and you get a bunch of free turns off of your Master Your Time's Garalks and a bunch of free cards off of your Dreamers and such that really just help you just take over games that would otherwise seem unwinnable. That's just the power of Master Your Time, I guess.
Yeah, Mono Sapphire has a couple of tempo tools that kind of puts it over the edge when it comes to the whole, I want to play my game and I don't care what you're doing because I'm just going to take control and keep doing what I want to do. You've got Time Ripple for either early game or late game. It's a great card if you have it in your opening hand, or if you top deck it on turn 6 or 7. You know, it can do a lot of different things. It can save a troop that's going to die that's on your side of the board. It can, you know, push a troop off the board so you can attack. It can do a lot of things. It can get rid of a Soul Marble, all that kind of good stuff. And then you have Buccaneer, which is a little more straightforward. You know, 2-drop, 3-drop, bounce your troop, puts you back a whole turn. Now I have a board state, you don't. Great card. And then, you know, Mastery of Time is like I hate playing against Mastery of Time, especially when it's paired with certain cards. But Indormy's laughing because he whooped me with Time Ripple, or with Mastery of Time on my latest episode of the Hextech Deck Tech earlier this month. But yeah, it's an amazing card. It's a 5-drop, so usually when you cast it, it's pretty much your whole turn, but if you're going to cast it, you usually have a plan for your next turn, so it doesn't really set you back the turn per se. You know, you're getting another shard drop, you're furthering your board state, you're getting to where you want to be, and kind of not only getting the other person across the board a little worried about what's going to happen, but it kind of throws them off like, oh no, could this be it? Is this the game already? So I like the tempo play. I personally think that mono-colored decks right now in the metagame are a little bit stronger than dual-colored decks. I think they're more consistent, and when I go into a tournament, that's what I want to be. I want to be consistent. I want to draw the opening hand I want to draw without mulliganing, hopefully. And I want to be able to do what I want to do. I want to be able to get on my plan as consistently as possible. And if I can't do that with a tricolor deck or a dual color deck, guess what? I'm not playing those. I'm going to go back to something monocolored because it's just, that's my game plan. I'm sticking to it and get the game over with. I want to win this game. I'm going to do it. Job's done.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that Monoslaver has some really good matchups. I just think that the aggro matchup, it's super dependent on turn 5, Rolcon, and Stalling. And if you don't get it, it's a little bit disastrous. You can help a little bit with the sideboard, but the sideboard options are not that fantastic. But I do think that Monoslaver has a good matchup, and so the control fields and other mid-range fields, and other mid-range decks. So I like the deck. I just always thought that the matchup against aggro wasn't fantastic, and that's the main weakness with Monoslaver. If you can avoid the aggro matchups or get a little bit lucky with it, it's a really powerful deck to play.
I mean, we're looking at how many round tournament is it going to be as we stand right now?
About six, I think.
We have, it's going to be a 6-round tournament. So, you know, you're probably going to hit one, if not two, aggro matchups, because I'm assuming there's going to be a lot of Gorefeast running around. So I think that maybe, I don't know. You know, your control matchups are okay. They're not great because Mono Sapphire is still counting on the beats to win the game. So, you know, I don't know. I think it's a decent deck. It's put up good results, so I'm not going to argue with that. But, you know, we're going to go on to one more deck that I don't know if we've decided what it is yet. Mythic, what are we going with?
I'm going to go with Mono Blood. I've been playing it for a while.
Boom, I like that.
I've been playing Mono Blood quite a bit. We were debating whether Mono Blood or Sapphire Diamond. Both are very good, but I know I've been just wrecking people with Mono Blood. The only problem with Mono Blood right now is that with the almost certain banning of Relentless Corruption, I think it gets weaker. Even though I know Phoenix was playing with a version without Relentless Corruption. I think Relentless Corruption is just too key to the deck almost in a lot of matchups. It's obviously bad in the aggro matchups, but even those, like, if you still have Gorefeast, is pretty sweet. Yeah, it's just too key to most of the control matchups to really get the deck over without having it. You could obviously go with the Pain and Drain version that Phoenix had up there. If you could check that out, I'll put it in the show notes so you can check the list out. And that was a really sweet deck, and that's what basically I've been playing, just a little different version with obviously Relentless Corruption over Harvesters. You gain so much life and you just draw a bunch of cards off your Pact of Pain. Obviously not as many as like Infinite Fog's going to, but the card draw just really grinds out the other control matchups. Again, this deck can have a little bit of trouble with time because, you know, a lot of times you're just drawing resource, eventually getting a Relentless Corruption or a Life Siphon or whatever to, you know, finally kill off your opponent or just get your plan going more. But, you know, obviously, again, the time constraints can be a bit of a problem, and without Relentless Corruption could be even a bigger problem.
I think that Monoblock is a really good deck, but I would not play Monoblock if I'm not playing Relentless Corruption, or if I cannot play Relentless Corruption.
Yeah.
I was actually going to play Mono Blood on the last tournament, but the correct ban of Relentless Corruption just shed me away from it. I think it's a really good deck, but I think that not having Relentless Corruption, it's a huge downgrade in power.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I have a personal affinity towards this deck. You know, I felt strongly that it was the right choice for the last challenge series. Round one, I faced Blood Diamond, crushed him 2-0, was able to just get the card advantage, stick my Vampire Kings, get the damage across, and finish it off. Round two was a Mono Wild Eye deck that I played against, and my Corrupt Harvesters, he just didn't have a way to deal with them. I mean, a 3-3 unblockable with lifelink kind of just puts you over the top when you have so much removal in your deck with terrible transfers and Pact of Pain to keep drawing and drawing and drawing and get to those important removal spells that you need. And then round three, I was playing against Function Fails. We were in game one. I had a commanding lead in game one, and then my internet crapped out, and I had to reconnect like six times. He ended up giving me game one because I had such a dominant position in the game. He was very gracious for doing that, and I applaud him for doing that kind of thing, because I was going to win game one. Game two, I couldn't stay connected, so I had to end up dropping out of the tournament. But I did feel as though I had a good matchup against almost all of the decks in the format. You know, Gore Storm, obviously it depends on the draw. You know, if they get the nut draw, I really don't have a chance unless I get a really strong removal heavy hand. But like I said, you know, I'm a big purveyor of, I don't want the Relentless Corruptions. I don't want your cards. I want my cards. I want the cards I want to draw. I want my Corrupt Harvesters, because unless you're playing Blood, they're going to do some work to you. And if you're not prepared for that, you're going to run away with the game off of three life per turn plus drawn cards, you know, plus removal. It's just a really strong, solid deck. So I know everybody out there, probably not just Mythic and Endormi, but everybody in Hex is saying Relentless Corruption, Relentless Corruption, Relentless Corruption, but it's just not the thing for me. I don't care what you have in your deck. I'm gonna beat you regardless. I don't want your cards, so I'll get my Corrupt Harvesters. You deal with them or you're dead. So that's how I feel about it. And I'm sorry if everybody looks at me and they're like, what, a Relentless Corruption, whatever. But screw you guys. I'm gonna play Corrupt Harvester, and I'm gonna beat you every game. Come challenge me in the Proving Grounds.
One card I do think makes the Mono Blood deck really, really powerful is Terrible Transfer. The ability to kill off a problematic troop, or even just kill your own troop to gain a bunch of life, is really, really powerful. I know I had a game where I was at 7 life, my opponent had 8 resources open the entire game, and I was playing around lifesafe by just holding a Terrible Transfer open and just waiting to Terrible Transfer my own dude to just not die to a lifesafe. And so it works as like a counter spell for a lifesafe, and it works as, you know, a way to get back in the game versus Gore Feast decks. It's very, very powerful. And the later the game goes, the better it gets too. And it also feeds into your Pact of Pains, which is really nice. So that's one of the cards I do think makes Mono Blood so good. Even though it's only like a 2 of in the deck, you do draw so many cards that you usually get to at least one or two of them. But yeah, I think that's a really undervalued card in that deck. But anyway, speaking of undervalued cards, we'll go to the Rares Without a Home segment here.
That's what we call a segue, people.
Segued all day. The first card we're going to speak about is one that's near and dear to my heart. I'm sure Endormi's as well, potentially Phoenix's. I can't speak for him, but I can definitely speak for myself and Endormi here. Judgment. This card is one I've been wanting to work so long. I've tried every different variant I possibly can to get the card to be amazing, and it's done some work, but obviously the fact that I'm saying it's undervalued means that it's not doing enough work to be in a tier one deck. But I do think if we get some more potentially like large spell shield troops, or even just some nice, you know, artifacts to ramp into this to then play like a Hex Engine turn two or whatever, instead of having to play it turn four, could maybe make it a little bit faster and make the effect a little bit more powerful. Or Judgment Dragon would be nice too. I can get behind that too. If you want to segue even more here, we can go Judgment Dragon, be fine.
I really like Judgment. I think it's like in the current meta, it could do a lot of work against the especially against other control decks, as all their Trouble Soul permanents are on the low side, like Soul Marvelous, costed 2, Solitary Exile 3, and then Vampire Kings are 3 and R4 and so forth. So you don't need anything super big to wipe most of the most troublesome stuff to deal with on set 1. So that's what I wanted to play Judgment so badly, just being able to destroy all of the stuff of your opponent, especially the cards that are so hard to remove in any with only the set 1 tools we have, felt really, really, really powerful. But unfortunately, there's a little bit of clunkiness with Judgment, as they can respond to the casting to and destroy your Judgment target, but the Judgment high-costed dude. So it was a little bit clunky against control in that regard. And it's also a little bit too slow against aggro. But I think that somewhere it's going to find a home if it's not on set 1 or set 2. Even if it's only like a one-off on control decks or something, I do feel that the effect is powerful enough to get a home somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I love Judgment too. I've been trying to brew many various colored decks with it over the last few months. The last one I was trying to work on was a Diamond Blood Ruby Judgment deck, which was just absolutely terrible. It was just terrible. It was working off of all six drops, like Castigator, the Hellhound, and something else. I can't remember what it was, but it was trying to stall until you get your six drops on the board, and then play Judgment and wipe everything off the board. And I think that's the sweet spot you need to be at. You need to be wiping six and under. But the good thing about Judgment is it wipes everything off the board, constants, artifacts, all that good stuff. The bad thing about Judgment is yes, it's slower than Extinction. Extinction's one of the pillars of the format right now, and I think you need to try and contend with that. If you're not beating an Extinction, you usually don't have a target to play your Judgment off of. Like, say you want to play a Drew and then next turn Judgment. If they cast Extinction, your plan is done. So I think it's a little slow. I think it doesn't necessarily have the right shell right now. I'd like to see some higher cost artifacts and constants that could give it a little bit of help. And not just higher cost crap constants and artifacts. Like, they have to be something that do significant work mid-range to late game. So I want to see that in set two, and I think this card's gonna be very good in the future. It's a sweeper effect that sweeps the entire board except for your one or two things or whatever. So it definitely needs to find a home, and I'm hoping that it gets a lot of help in set two. Mythic, what's our second card?
The second card is Shack Attack, Servant of Shack Attack, actually called Shatak, but Shack Attack's much more awesome. This card currently has a shell it works in, but I do think it needs some more 1 and 2 cost actions and so on, like maybe some more timerable type effects, maybe for like a 1 cost type deal. Maybe I'll set the same card for 1 cost, would be kind of redundant, but something like that. Maybe like a 1 cost counter magic or something like that. I'll say it'd be situational, but still 1 cost and 2 cost actions is what the card's really looking for and really what's missing right now. Obviously having the free angel and the soul marbles and stuff are pretty sweet. Again, you don't have a lot of redundancy with the effects you can do right now. Like, if we had some more bounce effects or some more counter magic effects, and maybe even some more like spell shieldy effects like Arcane Shield, maybe it would get a little more of a boost from that. But I do think it's missing the early actions to get it to go over the top.
I think that it needs, the problem with Shagadak is that it needs a lot of different cards that do the same thing. And with only one set or potentially even two sets, I don't think there's going to be a great shell around it. Also, the card is sweet, but it's not like a super payoff card. As I said, you need the whole deck to do the same thing. As it's not going to if you play a Shagadak turn one, it's not by no means going to win you the game alone in most cases. As the clock it pulls by itself, it's reasonable, but it's not super ahead of other one drops. So we have to see a lot of redundancy with the different names. So I don't think that set 2 is going to be enough. So I think the card has as potential and promise, and it's going to get better as more sets are released. I don't think set 2 is going to be the breakpoint, but I don't know. We'll see. If there's also the potential of having other cards with this effect that restrict your deck building, but that you can put them all together and that are above more than above average from their respective cost. But I don't know. I feel that as a 2/2 for one with flight, it's solid. I don't know. With one set or two sets, it's not enough to warranty its downside.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried various builds of Shack Attack. I think after closed beta came out, it was one of the first decks that I started trying to put together, just because I knew there was going to be a lot of random stuff running around, and I thought that, consistently hitting this turn one would get you a huge advantage. So, you know, I like the card, I like what it does, but like Endormi says, it doesn't really have a consistent home with what it's trying to do. Like, I've tried to do Mono Sapphire Shack Attack with, you know, random flying troops and bounces and blah blah blah. It just wasn't very consistent. It didn't seem like you were drawing the critical mass of cards in your hand that you needed to put it over the top. And, you know, you can pair it with other colors, like diamonds usually what most people lean towards with this, just because of the cheap removal spells that it gets early on in the game. But like you said, it, like a 2/2 for one is good. It's great if you draw a 4 in the first 4 turns, but that's probably not going to happen. So it's going to get to the point where they're removing it, and they just go on with their plan, and you're stuck with 1s and 2 drops in your hand. So I think that set 2 is going to make it the shell better. But like Indormy said, it's going to take multiple sets. I think by set three, this card will actually have a significant archetype to fit into, and I think it's going to be a real threat. But until then, I think it's kind of a funsy card. Like, if you want to have some fun, you want to try some weird crap, just throw it into a deck and play with it and see if you can beat somebody out early in the game.
I think, yeah, just one additional. I mean, more than just getting your hand after the Shaga deck is removed, is that you play Shaga deck as, like, one of the best cards in your deck. So if Shaga deck gets removed or whatever, you are stuck with a deck that right now, as you don't have the consistency to draw the same thing as real effects, you get super one and two drops. It's not that you get your hand stuck with one and two drops, it's that you get super one and two drops.
Also, like, Shaka Tech gets outclassed by an angel or a vampire, so like you need the more tempo-y cards to come out to really be able to deal with those cards that just outclass your Shaka Tech early on in the game. And again, if an angel comes out turn two and you don't have a bounce spell for it, you're kind of just sitting there with a 2/2 that can't do anything. But yeah, so on to the next card, we got Mystic Spirit Walker, a card that's very powerful and has been in the Shaka Attack builds. I think that was the one that Wordle did, right?
I don't know if it was Shaka Attack, but I know he run the deck.
Yeah, it was in Shaka Attack then, because I know he played Shaka Attack in that list. But Spirit Walker is a card that I think the effect is really unique and is very good in the creature matchups, troop matchups rather. The only problem right now is that we don't have a lot of troop matchups. We have more of just pump my marble go type matchups. So with that, Spirit Walker isn't the greatest. I mean, he does make your troops able to block marbles for a few turns and, you know, you can go that route, but he then dies to marbles. So doesn't really have a great home right now. And I think the metagame just isn't right for Spirit Walker. So I could see him getting maybe a bit of a boost from set two, depending on what we get, or depending on what that does to the meta, more likely.
Yeah, I think that Mystic Spirit Walker is, just said, meta-dependent, and also the combination of being bugged throughout the alpha and not having good animations for his effect during beta has made people not want to play with this card a lot, as it was thrown as a super bug card. But yeah, the effect is really, really powerful, but it's not right in meta for him, as coming as a 4-drop, you can just get Gore Fisted in the creature matchup, and in the control matchup it's just not doing enough. But no, yeah, as a space elite, I also think that it needs the right meta for him. But
yeah, I agree.
If we get there, right, it's a really, really powerful effect.
And I agree. I think that this card is great in a troop heavy dominated metagame, but as both of them just stated, it's really not that right now. And I would like to add that this has probably been the most annoying card for me throughout my life in Hex. I don't know how many times I've asked somebody what they targeted with their Mystic Spirit Walker and I got no response. I don't know whether that they didn't want to tell me or if they weren't paying attention or whatever, but it was pretty annoying when you end up blocking something and you just died to it because you didn't know that it was invulnerable or whatever. So I like that this card has potential to go into a different metagame later in Hex. But as of right now, as both Mythica and Adormi stated, it's too slow for what's going on right now in the game, and it doesn't bring anything to the matchup for Gorfy-style decks or control-style decks. It just falls short. And until we get a little more troop-based, I'm going to be passing on this card.
All right, so the next card we have here is one that I know I was pumped about when it originally was spoiled, or when it originally came into the alpha, rather. Shrine of Prosperity. This card we spoke about a little bit last week, and why we think it might get a little bit better from set two, because the charges may become more relevant in set two, as well as with different champions may become a little bit more powerful. But the effect with lowering your card's cost and pumping up your troops, I think it's a card that should probably be more played than it is, but the problem is that it's a turn two, you just don't do anything but play a Shrine of Prosperity, and that can be a key turn, especially in the Gore Feast matchups, to actually affect the board. So it's a two cost that doesn't actually affect the board when it comes into play and gives your opponent perfect information for your hand. So that's the reason why it's not getting played now, but I do think that the effect it has is powerful enough to maybe go overcome its downside.
I don't think the card is really good. I used to play it on Mono Sapphire with it, because I think that card on Mono Sapphire is busted. But you play for Shrines and you get run over to aggro. But the card is super busted with Wyatt, because at some point you start drawing two cards a turn with that, which is really, really good. And I think that it pushes also a lot of creatures that have troubles on with the just
due to the defense or attack being in a bad range with, for example, 2 defense or 3 attack. And if you are able to pump your troops to that extra point, it matters a lot, as they surely cannot deal with your creatures too. And about the information thing, it's only relevant in some decks. In other decks, some other decks, you really don't care too much about what you're giving them.
Yeah, I've tried Shrine in quite a few different shells. The one that I always fell back on was Mono Sapphire as well. Just because Mono Sapphire's troops are a little bit on the weaker side when it comes to toughness and attack. But I think that this card is going to be making leaps and bounds in future sets. And I think one thing that I hope to see in set 2, I don't know if we're going to get it. It might be a little too powerful this early in the game's life, is manipulation of the top card of your deck, or top cards of your deck. I think if you're able to cast actions that allow you to put certain cards on the top of your deck without your opponent knowing what they are, I think that this card's going to get a huge push, and I think it's going to be something that's going to go up in value for everybody if we see those effects coming up in later sets.
One of the things that is, I don't think that's going to happen, and I will be surprised if that happens. I talk about this just because when Eye of Creation was spoiled in the end, if you have an effect that able to manipulate the top of your library, especially like put one card from your hand or like check a couple of cards from the top of their library and put one on top, it just makes, well, I use Creation for one and cheat something into play that it's almost unbeatable or the best creature card in Hex or whatever, and just go from there.
That's the nature of combo, man.
Yeah, but there's combo and combo.
Yeah, like I said, it's probably too early in Hex's life to be able to do that, but you know, I think that once we do have, if we ever have those kind of effects, I think it's going to make this card pretty sweet.
I think it's okay. I don't think it's going to, I mean, it has, more than that, is it has a good interaction or an interesting interaction with shuffle effects. You see what you are going to draw before you draw it, so you can say that way if you have some way of shuffling your library, and that's really powerful. But yeah, also there's also one issue with this card, which is really, really, really annoying, is that you're not able to order your triggers on the start of the turn, so you can get completely screwed with this card. Yeah, I mean, one of the main issues is, for example, you're playing Mono Sapphire, you want to play Chosen, for example, and you want to play this card, well, then you have to be really careful how you play the cards, because if you play it in some way, the Shrine effect resolves first, and then the Chosen shuffles the 2 Spectres, and it messes up with the top of your deck. And when you play multiples of them, it also gets completely random, with no clear way to distinguish how the triggers are going to work. So that also hurts the card a lot.
All right, well, the next card that can be played in the Shrine of Prosperity deck, Archmage Renlock. A card that's obviously very powerful now, just the ability to have it has in general is very powerful. But I do think, again, like what I was saying with Shack Attack, if you get a bunch of 1 and 2 cost actions, I think this card gets infinitely better. A 1 cost, you know, bounce spell being thrown at your Renlock to protect it from a murder or whatnot, and drawing a card is a very powerful effect, as well as just in general being able to have the tempo as well as drawing cards again. If you get like a 1 or 2 cost counter magic, can be very powerful with it. So I think as we get more lower cost actions, which we almost certainly will be, I think this card's going to get a giant push in playability, because it's just such it's a unique ability in Hex. We have nothing like this. It's also just a very powerful ability in general.
The effect is busted. It's really, really busted. The only thing lacking is that we don't have the card pool to support it, but the effect is really, really busted. In fact, they nerfed the original Relic, because it was just too good. See, they also reduced the...
That was way too good.
Yeah. Well, but it was too good, it was just degenerate. It just made it self-degenerate. That was the main issue, I believe. I mean, the only issue with Relic that made him not see more play in future sets is his cost. Being 4 costed may be too slow seeing how Eternal formats are going to develop in Hex. But this card the effect is really, really busted. If we get 1 Sapphire, draw a card, that effect is just busted with Relic.
Yeah.
No, I mean, one Sapphire, draw a card, just without any other tech, that card is whatever, it's not super powerful. But when you get with stuff with Relic, it suddenly becomes so, so, so good. Same with cheap counterspell, if you get 1 mana, pawns the spell to their hand, or stuff like that, each Renlo just starts spiking in power really, really, really hard. So he just needs the correct actions to put in the deck, but he's really, the effect is really, really, really busted.
Go ahead.
And he can only get better.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I really like the design of this card. It makes you want to play troops and actions in a different way than you're usually intending to. There's two decks that I think that Renlock shines in very well, and that's mill decks. He tends to shine pretty well in sapphire based mill decks, not necessarily blood, but he works really well because you're milling the opponent, you're drawing cards, you're getting together mill effects, and he works really well there. And then also in the Firebird decks, if anybody's seen Mantic's Firebird deck that he posted on our website, it works really well because basically all you're trying to do is draw cards, and he shines in those style of decks. The main issue with Renlock for me is he's a little slow and he's not easily protected. When he hits the board, he is must answer. Otherwise, you really start to lose the card advantage battle. So I think if we get additional protection, cheaper protection effects, he's gonna get a huge jump, and also just cheaper actions in general. He's probably gonna be played more than he is now.
Yo, I was playing with him before in a it had him and Shrine of Prosperity in the deck, and I shrunk a Relentless Corruption out of one cost, and then played him plus Relentless Corruption, which was pretty sweet. Grabbing like a timer pull of my opponent's deck, and then being able to protect it with a timer pull, and then happened to hit the same Relentless Corruption that was already now down to a one cost, down to be a negative one cost, so it was free. So Relentless Corruption for free, had timer pull for backup, and just drew a million cards off of it. And just sitting back and just chilling, just like, yeah, dude, I'll just draw all your cards, not even a big deal, like, it's fine. So you just keep drawing into more Relentless Corruptions, or if you're playing, you know, if that's anything you want to go for in the tournament, where Relentless Corruption will be banned, you play the Sapphire Diamond, get like free repels off Shrine of Prosperities, or, you know, one cost timer pulls and stuff like that. It just becomes really, really powerful, just protecting your Renlock with bounce effects and removal spells such as repel and stuff. The card's so good as is now, and then if we just get a bunch more free or one cost actions, it's gonna be just disgusting in the future. But on to the last card, because we're running low on time here.
Well, 1 second about Renlock. It's that, I mean, to be fair, although the effect is really powerful, he has some clunkiness on it, which I called from the start of the alpha the Renlock effect, is that you want to run a deck with basically mostly actions with Renlock, but then when you play Renlock, the chance of your opponent having the removal that he was not been able to cast in any of your troops, because you don't have any, so it's just whenever you play Renlock, it's the chance of him just getting murdered or whatever are really high. And if you play it on a high density troop deck, then the effect is not nearly as good, and you're playing overcosted 3/3 that sometimes throws you a card. So you have to find the sweet spot with it, and have the cards to support it.
All right, for real this time though, on the Legionnaire Gawain, the last card we have in the set here. They did say they're going to be cutting down Inspire, I think, a little bit. Maybe I misheard that, but I thought they said they're not going to have Inspire as focused in the next set. So maybe he won't get an uptick from that. But I do think, like, even just in the reserves of the Ruby Sapphire Gorfy sets, where he's going to do, like, 1 or 2 points of damage, maybe draw you a card off of a Mentalist Inspire. I do think he shines in those kind of, like, in that kind of situation, where he's a one-sided heat wave that draws you cards. He's just, I don't know, the card right now is powerful, and I think if we get, like, even just something like, just any random Inspire triggers, if we get the original Mirror Knight Inspire trigger, whereas if they get targeted, they have to pay 2 more or whatever it was, even just that ability to have on a 4/4 for 5 is not horrible at all, and pinging your opponent for 1 and drawing a card potentially off of the Mentalist or whatnot, just, I don't know, seems pretty sweet to me in general as now.
I mean, always, same as with Judgment, one-sided sweeper effects are really, really powerful. What you said about Inspire not going to get as much support, I do believe we're going to get more Inspire support on the next set, especially because it's going to keep... Inspire is a human mechanic, and the next set, I think, it still features the same 4 races as set 1.
It does,
so, yeah. The thing is that after set 2, we may not see more Inspire or little to Inspire, as human is not going to be a race as a showcase, especially for set 3 and 4, where are the other 4 races. So, while though getting more cards, it's going to help with Legionnaire,
it's also we are not going to have a huge pool to play with him. But again, as I said before, the one-sided sweeper effects are really, really good, and it can definitely in creature matchups, Legionary it's completely ends the game. You completely wipe their board. It gets a bunch of triggers. If you get Mentalist, you draw cards from it. It's really, really, really good on creature matchups. It, in the same way as Mystic Speedwalker, but it does have an underplay trigger, which is kind of interesting. Well,
if you look at the Inspire deck I played in the Challenge Series, he was like a fireball that drew me a card, gained me a bunch of life, and then bash in for four because it had speed most of the time too. So if you just get even just an Inspire based deck, Legionnaire is just disgusting. He's really the best card in Inspire decks. Like there's nothing even close to as good as him.
Oh, absolutely.
Even Victoria is pretty sweet in those decks because the life drain can become very relevant, and the Mentalist is pretty sweet. But Legionnaire is what makes those decks work. And if we get some more powerful Inspire triggers, which I think we will, because I think the ones we have now, most of them are kind of underwhelming. Obviously, Mirror Knight rather is absurdly overpowered. Maybe not overpowered, just absurdly powerful in general. And then Mentalist is pretty sweet with them as well. But I think if we get some more sweet Inspire triggers, which apparently we're going to, he could just become just a powerhouse.
I'm going to preface this with Legionnaire of Gwaim is going to be busted in set two. And there's one card that's going to make it busted, and that's the Blink Wizard. I don't know the exact name. Corey didn't.
Time
I don't
Step
think
Wizard,
Corey gave
said.
Us the exact name. Maybe he did. Time Step Wizard. The one that comes into play, blinks out a troop, and brings him back into play. With Legionnaire of Gwaim, that is ridiculous. If you have a Blessing of the Fallen on board, or a Mentalist, or a Princess Victoria, not only when he deals that damage after he blinks back in, you're going to get all those other triggers off of that. So that's going to be something to look out for, and I've been excited for Blessing of the Fallen decks getting better with Set 2. There's going to be some Inspire effects. I don't know if it's going to be a key mechanic in Set 2 or not. Probably not. But I think any extra Inspire triggers with the three-color Blessing of the Fallen deck is going to push this card way over the top, and it's going to be a force to be reckoned with. I think that's about going to wrap it up for this week, guys. We're a little over time, so hopefully Mythic can do his magic and edit out some of the crappy parts and get this down under an hour for you guys, because we don't like to drag this out. One thing that we forgot to talk about was Threshold Podcast is doing a giveaway at Gen Con this weekend, and then also on Twitter and on their the official forums of Hex. We're going to put the link up here in the description of the podcast, but they're giving away some sweet art that they've put on the canvas, and the two that they show is Tyrannosaurus Hex and Dreamer, and they're awesome. They look so good, and I would love to have this hanging up in my office while I play some Hex. So make sure you check that out in the link in the description below. I'd like to thank everyone for coming in, tuning in to episode 2 of On the Draw. We're going to be back again next week talking about different topics. Hopefully we don't bore you guys. I'd like to thank Mythic Fish Mom and Adormi for coming and hanging out with me again. What do you guys have to say in closing?
Nothing much. Just thanks for hanging out, guys. Thanks as always. If you guys enjoy the content, be sure to throw some feedback in the forums. Always nice to hear your appreciation. This one should probably be on iTunes in a reasonable amount of time. The last one gave me a bit of trouble. I had to fight some bosses, slay some dragons and stuff to get it on there. And apparently, I don't even know if it's still on there at all. But we'll figure this one out. This one will be up there in a normal amount of time. So if you want to throw a iTunes review at us, that'd be awesome as well. But yeah, thanks for hanging out, guys.
Yep. Adios.
All right. Once again, guys, in closing, Thursday night on twitch.tv/HexTechsTV, we're going to be doing the Hextex Open. That's going to be the preview show for the Hextex Open that's happening on Saturday morning. Make sure you check out that live. Make sure you check out HexTex.tv for all the latest content that we're putting up on there. And hopefully we'll be back next week. No, we will be back next week now, hopefully. But we'll see you next week. Thank you again. And, yeah, take care.